We wanna smash, crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, 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 we want. We want a liberated land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back Dr. Aaron Good. He teaches at a private school in Pennsylvania, and he recently held a very fascinating event with historic whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. The event was rather a tribute to Ellsberg and involved several surprise guests, luminaries, if you will, including James Galbraith, Peter Kuznick, Catherine Gunn, and Peter Dale Scott. On today's program, we'll introduce this momentous occasion and we'll share this conversation with you. Stay tuned.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're going to share with you a fantastic event. Luminaries joined Peace Studies class for a tribute to Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. We welcome back here at the beginning of the program Dr. Aaron Good. He was the person that put this event together and facilitated the event. He teaches at a private Quaker school in Pennsylvania. Aaron Good has a PhD in political science from Temple University. Aaron Good also helped put together historic conversations between Peter Dale Scott and Daniel Ellsberg that we aired previously on the Project Censored Show. And we are grateful to welcome Aaron Good back to the show today. Aaron, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, thanks, Mickey. It's great to be here again.
Aaron, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You're doing stellar work. And imagine having a teacher like you at a high school that brings in people like Daniel Ellsberg to talk to students. And then, as if that's not enough, you had surprise guests, including James Galbraith, Peter Kuznick, Catherine Gunn, and Peter Dale Scott. Aaron Good, introduce this conversation, this panel that we're sharing today. You were kind enough to share the audio and video with us of this historic conversation. Tell us a little bit about it and tell us about the amazing folks that you welcomed into the classroom.
This came together very serendipitously. The course itself that I teach is an elective that I've created in collaboration with Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick. And I've also been taking students to Japan to tour Hiroshima and Nagasaki with Professor Kuznick. Additionally, my dissertation works in an area pioneered by Peter Dale Scott. And so I recently co-authored an article with him that we discussed on the show not too long ago. And I've done those events in the past with Daniel Ellsberg. He did that event out there in California with you and Project Censored. So I have a relationship with these people. And the other two people that I didn't mention already, James Galbraith, I knew he was very close friends with Peter Dale Scott. And so I'd actually been in contact with him a few months earlier. And then Catherine Gunn is on Facebook and is approachable. And I came to them with this idea of surprising Dan and having something of a tribute for him, for my students, that it would be a chance for them to see what these other people, how important they believe Ellsberg and his contribution to history, that all those things are. It came together very nicely. They all agreed to do it kind of at the last minute. So this class happened as a follow-up to one that we're also going to show on Project Censored, which was with Peter Dale Scott, and it was for him and his work on Indonesia. And I surprised him with Daniel Ellsberg because I knew they were the best of friends. And also Joshua Oppenheimer, the director of The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence, two Oscar-nominated documentaries about the Indonesian massacre in 1965. So that show will probably air sometime soon for your listeners. But the one today was just a very heartwarming and sort of illuminating conversation with all of these people talking about very serious subjects, the Vietnam War, the Pentagon Papers, whistleblowing, nonviolent resistance, nuclear war, and just issues of war and peace that really hang over all of humanity. So it ended up coming together in a way that I couldn't have scripted any more perfectly.
Well, Aaron Good, what a list, as you stated in the article that we have at projectcensored.org at the notebook. You wrote up a brief summary of this event. Luminaries indeed, from Daniel Ellsberg, Pentagon Papers fame, also author of Secrets, a Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers and the Doomsday Machine. I believe that your students were reading excerpts from some of these books. What an opportunity for the students to be able to speak with these folks. For those that don't know, of course, Peter Kuznick, author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States, Peter Dale Scott, a scholar of the deep state, retired Berkeley professor and Canadian diplomat, former Canadian diplomat, James Galbraith, who's chair of government business relations and professor of government at University of Texas, and of course, Catherine Gunn, the British woman who was charged under the UK's Official Secrets Act after she blew the whistle on U.S. efforts to spy on, blackmail, and coerce states into supporting the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. And that information and more is in the piece that you wrote up, Aaron Good, that's published over at Project Censored. So set up what we're about to hear, Aaron Good. Your voice is in here with the rest of these other great people.
Daniel Ellsberg has been invited to my class to answer questions about the readings and the material that you just mentioned, especially things related to nuclear weapons and to the Pentagon Papers and the Vietnam War. And he knows that Peter Dale Scott is going to be there, but he didn't know that any of the other people were going to be there. And they had been told to prepare anecdotes and observations for about 5 or 6 minutes each. And so they all had very nice things to say about Dan. And then there's some back and forth between all of us. And it ends up being a very heartwarming, at times funny, most of the time very, very serious, but happy at the same time, because it's such a tribute to Dan that he wasn't expecting.
Well, Aaron Good, it is generous of you to share this recording and this audio with Project Censored. I'm sad to say that given the roster of these people, one would hope that these people would not only be common names in the U.S., but that they would routinely have platforms in the major media or corporate media. Unfortunately, most of these folks do not. Regardless of their historical significance and how much they've contributed, Ellsberg and Peter Dale Scott, these people are in their late 80s and their early 90s, a couple of the guests here. So again, Aaron Good, we're grateful at Project Censored that you've not only been able to put together these events for your students, how fortunate for your academic community, in our opinion, that you're able to do this. But again, thank you for sharing this, and we are looking forward right now to sharing the audio of this conversation and this discussion with our listeners. Luminaries join Peace Studies class from Dr. Aaron Good. It's a tribute to Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg.
Peter is going to start us off. Peter Kuznick.
Dan Ellsberg. Dan is one of my closest friends and really an inspiration. Dan, as you all know, is probably America's most prominent whistleblower. He's been an inspiration, not only to me, but to Ed Snowden, to Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, to all of the prominent whistleblowers. I'm going to let Catherine Gunn speak for herself. But Dan has been not only an inspiration based on what he did, but he's been also a support team and a defense team. He's led the defense participated in defense of many of the whistleblowers. So when John Kerry, the former Secretary of State and presidential candidate, said that Dan was a model, Ed Snowden should follow Dan's example and come back here and stand trial, Dan commented that Kerry's remarks were despicable because Ed Snowden would not be able to stand trial, would not be able to defend himself given the nature of the Espionage Act. You can't make a public interest defense. So Dan, in releasing the Pentagon Papers when he did, and he tried to get them out much earlier, as you know, Dan faced 115 years in prison. If you know Dan, it's hard to imagine Dan spending 115 years in prison. There are few people who love life, love freedom, love expression more than Dan Ellsberg. But Dan was willing to do that because he thought it might contribute to ending the Vietnam War. And it did. And they're also contributed, we later found out, to bringing down the Nixon administration. But Dan came back to Vietnam with me. The first time, several years ago, I was bringing my students to Vietnam for an alternative spring break trip. And so I decided I was going to invite Dan to come with us. And it was wonderful to see, because in Vietnam, the Vietnamese consider Dan to be an absolute hero. They appreciate his sacrifice. They appreciate what he did. And so we were treated wonderfully by the Vietnamese. Madam Binh came to speak to our group, chief negotiator. General Giap, I think at that point, General Giap was, maybe he was 100 years old or close to 100 years old, but he couldn't wait to express his gratitude to Dan either. This is General Giap, who defeated the French, defeated the Americans, and is a true hero. So, but Dan is so committed. For example, I organized the first teach-in after the start of the Iraq War. And Dan flew in from California to join us. We had said it because we knew the war was coming, the bombing was about to begin. And so Dan flies in the night before and he calls me up on his way back from the airport and said, "Peter, why don't you come join me? Let's go to the Pentagon and get arrested." I said, "Dan, we've got this big teach-in tomorrow. It's gonna be on national television. It's gonna be the first one. We can't get arrested tonight." But he said, I have to go down there. So he goes down there, gets arrested. He's the keynote speaker at this big national teach-in. Fortunately, I got a lawyer to go down there at midnight and sprung Dan at 3 a.m. So he was able to come to our teach-in the next day. Dan and I share a lot of interests and a lot of concerns. Dan is one of the few people I know who is as obsessed with the threat of nuclear winter as I am. Dan thinks in terms of worst case scenarios, and he tries to prevent them from happening. And the one that he and I obsess on, probably more than any other, is the danger of nuclear war, and especially the implications of nuclear winter and ending all life on the planet, or as Dan would say, all large life forms on the planet. Dan also helped me enormously in doing my project, The Untold History of the United States. When Oliver Stone and I would go out to California to do some of our lectures around untold history, I would always stay with Dan, and Dan would often come and speak with us. We did some events at Stanford and other places in California, and Dan was always a supporter. He also saved me from innumerable errors in the chapters on the 1950s and 1960s and subsequent chapters. So Dan has been a mentor, a friend, a comrade, an inspiration, a role model. I love Dan, and I'm very happy to be here with you and Dan today.
Thank you very much, Peter. It looks like Dan is here.
Can I fill in, I think, for your students something that they should hear about that? First, it wasn't at the Pentagon. I got arrested with code pink in front of the White House in Lafayette Square. And they had the code pink people surrounded by police. And I sort of had to throw myself through some police and land in front of it because they were not letting anybody in or out. Got arrested with him. Well, it was an interesting arrest, which I won't go into the details now. But the reason I wanted to be arrested was that they were about to have shock and awe on Baghdad. And I really felt, I'm an American citizen, the time for this is to be in jail protesting this. And I don't want to be watching on television this horrible scene of their bombarding Baghdad. And so we got arrested, and the other people, we were hogtied, actually, literally hogtied. It was one of the few times in a gym they had us, a whole lot of us, with our wrists shackled to our ankles. And I guessed, and I'm pretty sure this was true, they were practicing for real terrorists, you know, for a big protest. Nobody had ever done this before. So I didn't sight out. And I was sent to another jail. And actually, I told them at the time, when he said, "Why aren't you sighting out? You know, just sign a thing and give a fine or something, or say you'll appear later." And I said, "I don't want to be watching what's going to happen in Iraq on television." He said, "Well, we're going to put you in a general cell with the television, where you'll see it anyway, he said, I'm joking or not. But actually, what they did was put me in a single cell in a distant jail somewhere. You'll see where I'm getting with this in a moment. The guy who was transporting me there, he said, couldn't you afford the fine? And I said, yeah, I could afford the fine, but I wanted to be in jail at this time. It was a place to be. And he said, well, where did you get an idea like that? I said, have you ever heard of someone named Thoreau? And he said, no. And I said, well, look it up. You know, there's this guy, Henry David Thoreau. And I told him a little, you know, when we're invading Mexico and we're having slaves and so forth, the place for an honest man to be is in jail protesting that. I don't think I told him all that. I just said, look him up. Put me in a cell, lying on the steel bunk, no mattress, without a pillow or anything. It's kind of hard, you know, to steal the thing. I took my shoe off. They'd taken my shoelaces and my wallet and everything, my watch. So I remember putting a shoe under my head to try to lie there. I was thinking of that when I saw the troops in the Capitol the other night, you know, lying on the floor. And I was thinking, no pillow, where the hell, that's hard. Anyway, 3 a.m, the guy comes and says, your lawyer is here. And he'd found me somehow. Thanks to Peter, I guess, that they checked the other jail. I was out on the street, just to tell you, because he said, okay, you're free. You've been sprung, something. I said, I don't have any money. I don't have any identification. Can I make a call? I was going to call Peter or call. No. I said, just on the office phone, or you can let me, you know. No. I said, you're just going to put me out on the street here? He said, yeah. And this may sound funny, but I said, would you want your mother treated like this? And he said, my mother wouldn't get arrested. So I'm out on the street at 3 a.m, alone in this, in a neighborhood I didn't recognize at all. There's, of course, no taxis or no nothing, no phone. And it didn't look like an entirely safe neighborhood. So a car comes up, and it's the lawyer. He's funny. So here's what I was driving at. I asked him, because he said Peter had sprung me. Oh, I remember I was saying, I don't really want to. I want to be in here. He said, no, you got to be here. You got to be here for this teach-in. So on the way, we stopped at a bookstore, and I bought a copy of Civil Disobedience, Essay on Civil Disobedience. And I spent most of my talk to these students, and I don't know whether Peter was happy with this or not at all, because I really read a lot of the essay on disobeying civil authority. I wanted to tell this to the students because that really does pay rereading many times, and it had big influence on me. I had my son read it before he helped me copy the Pentagon Papers when he was 13, to let him understand what I was doing. And I do feel that in the intervening 50 years or whatever it is since the Pentagon Papers, I have been derelict in not talking as much as I should about the sources that influenced me, namely Thoreau's Defying Civil Authority, Essay on Civil Disobedience, but in particular Gandhi, and an essay by, I want to say here now for the students, and I would hope they would write it down, but Barbara Deming, D-E-M-I-N-G, called Revolution and Equilibrium, which again I've read many times and had a major influence on me, that one argument about the need for nonviolence and the power of nonviolence. And Martin Luther King's Stride Toward Freedom, which I read at the same time, about his relation to the bus boycott, and a book on Gandhi called The Conquest of Violence by Joan Bondurant, B-O-N-D-U-R-A-N-T. And I sort of thought that talking about Gandhian things would sound something like a cult or too exotic. And I haven't told it as much as I should. So I'm happy to have the chance to tell your students that I would urge them to read these.
James, if you could take it from here.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I just want to thank you, Aaron, for doing this. And to me, it's really just a pleasure and an honor to be included on this occasion. And Aaron asked me to say a few words about Dan's historical significance. I think Peter's basically covered that. So I first of all just want to say that, as I think you recognize, you're in the presence of a really extraordinary form of courage, actually two forms of courage. And I want to cover Peter Scott with this as well. One of them is the courage to stand up to authority for what you believe and what you know to be right, and to do so persistently over a long period of time. And the other one is the courage just to pursue the truth in a serious way and to do so with care and in a way which will leave a record for future generations about how this should be done. These are two exemplary human beings who exhibit both of those forms of courage to the very highest degree. Many people who have these traits are a little bit on the fanatic side, and that is also not the case here. We're talking about very, very reasonable, serious people. So to me, as I say, it's an honor to be here. I do want to tell three short stories that relate to our engagement with Dan Ellsberg over the years. The first is that my father, who had served as Kennedy's ambassador to India in the early 1960s, came out to Los Angeles to testify for the defense in Dan's trial. And my understanding of his argument was basically that as ambassador, he had access to secret and top secret material. And when he held press conferences, he realized that no journalist would show up unless they thought there was a chance he was going to spill some of those secrets. So he gave the jury a little bit of instruction into what the true nature of the secrecy system actually was from his personal experiences to elevate the status of the person who happens to hold the clearances. And that wasn't decisive in the trial. It was decisive was the misconduct of the government, but it appeared to at least have some effect and might have had some effect if the case had gone to the jury. Second story is a college story, because I was a sophomore in college in 1971, and I had a roommate who was a Lebanese-American bass player from Cleveland by the name of Joe Sa. And Joe had a side job, which was working in what was then a very high technology operation, which was a Xerox shop on Massachusetts Avenue in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And one Sunday night in February, he came home to our quad and said, you know, some guy who said he was a history professor at MIT came in with a big box of documents and said he was writing a history of Vietnam, and he wanted five copies, and there were 7,000 pages of them, and they were all stamped top secret. And whenever Joe spotted my dad's name or the name of one of our other roommates whose father had been ambassador in Thailand on the documents, he made an extra copy. And so we pored over 40 or 50 pages on 4 or 5 months before they were published on the front page of the New York Times. And when my dad called me to say I should get the Times, he said, 7,000 pages of history on Vietnam. I said, 7,000 pages? Oh, I've already seen those. So that's my second story. And my third story relates to this photograph, which has to do with the visit of a magician to my father's house in Cambridge around 2004. A magician encountered my then 7-year-old daughter, Eve, and proceeded to show off some of his wares with handkerchiefs and coins. At a given point, she called him on a trick. I think it was he produced a quarter from behind his ear, and she named what it was. He said, "Now, how does a 7-year-old know a professional magician's term like that?" And she said, "I read a book." So I think they were kindred spirits. In any event, not only historical significance, not only courage, but pretty decent human being. I mean, a really decent human being. So I think we can all be really happy to be here today. That's all I've got. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for that, James. Dan, did you have any response about James and experience of having his father testify?
Of course, his testimony was very helpful. McNamara, by the way, had refused to testify similarly. The key issue was, did this really endanger national security? And they knew it didn't. But McNamara said, "I will hurt your client very badly if you compel me to be on the stand." Meaning he would say that it had hurt national security, I guess. But anyway, yeah, that story was amazing. I'd always assumed that when people made copies, that they would notice some of these stamps. They weren't all stamped top secret. We cut a lot of them off, but there were always some that we had missed because they were stamped on and they weren't all stamped at the top of the page. So anyway, as your father said, Jamie, to me about it later, he said, when I heard this was coming out, he said, I thought, you know, they'll have my cables from India, and I hope they're as good as I remember them. He said he was afraid that his advice to Kennedy might not stand up after years as well as he remembered it in his head. But then he read it, and they did, so he was happy about that. He had been one of the ones who, from 61 on, had said, don't get into this. This is, you know, a total mess.
I can't resist adding a slightly off-color story, which one of the letters that my father sent to Kennedy complained about the delivery of supersonic jets to Pakistan, which he said had been conducted with all of the discretion that one would associate with mass sodomy on the IRT at rush hour. And the IRT was the New York subway. And when the book was going to galleys, I'm going to proofs, I read this back to him. He was at that point at a great age, stretched down on his bed. And he said, oh, yes, I put that in so that he would keep reading.
No, he was a great, he was a terrific writer, very jealous of him in the economics department because he was the one economist who wrote gracefully.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're listening to a conversation with Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg was invited to speak this past February via Zoom to a high school class in Peace Studies taught by Aaron Good. Aaron also secretly invited several other notable authors and activists to join the class, which became a tribute to Ellsberg. We just heard an exchange where Professor James Galbraith spoke about the work of his father, John Kenneth Galbraith. He did try to head off the Vietnam War during the John F. Kennedy administration. The elder Galbraith was U.S. ambassador to India at that time. After this music break, we'll shift back to the present day as Aaron Good asks Ellsberg a question about Julian Assange. After that, British whistleblower Catherine Gunn and author Peter Dale Scott will join the conversation. Stay tuned.
What advice you would have for Assange and Assange supporters, which would include all of us?
Well, I've been spending a lot of time in the last few months on this question of his extradition. I've been, so happens, reading a lot about the process in the Times, the New York Times, when they were doing the Pentagon Papers. And of course, they were in the position Assange was in. As a matter of fact, Assange, again, put them in that position by sharing a lot of the material with the New York Times and others. And at the time, they were worried, there were dozens, a couple dozen people working on this at the New York Hilton, may have committed a felony. Well, no one had ever been prosecuted for that before, and no one has since, until Assange, that is, in the press business. Now, the wording of the Espionage Act that was used against me, 18 U.S.C. 793 paragraph E, in this case, for unauthorized, which I know very well because I was the first person ever prosecuted under that part of the Espionage Act. And it applies in the wording just as well to anybody who handles the material or who doesn't turn it in or who passes it to someone else, which was true of everyone in the New York Hilton operation. Now, they were worried about it. As I say, I, as a source, hadn't been prosecuted before. But since then, there have been more than a dozen people prosecuted, although the constitutionality of doing that with respect to a source has never been addressed in the Supreme Court. And it's very definitely challengeable under the First Amendment that that is too much of a restriction of freedom of the press. The point is that Assange is now prosecuted as the people in the New York Hilton all could have been. And the publisher and the editors. And now it's happening. And I've been warning news people for half a century now, that wording can be turned against you. And they were feeling safe because it hadn't been, and that seemed too blatant a violation of the First Amendment to do it, but not to Trump. And if Assange is extradited on these grounds. And the judge so far has ruled against it on personal grounds, on health grounds mainly. But if he is extradited on this and prosecuted in the current climate, especially in Alexandria court, he will almost certainly be convicted. And he will not be the last. So that it will be a crime then to, as the New York Times people had feared, to have any dealings with anything still stamped top secret or confidential. And it will mean the public relies only on handouts. Put it this way, think of Fox News being the only news channel. It is the only news channel for the Trump followers. And giving what they believe, that the election was stolen and so forth, what should they do about it? They do believe it. Well, the effect of this would be, you would get, as on Fox, what the president wants you to hear. That's it. And we would have more wars like Vietnam and Afghanistan in Iraq. So it's very serious. A lot hangs on Assange not being extradited. And as someone who's met very friendly basis with Assange in London twice in the Ecuadorian embassy and with him earlier before he was under arrest, I personally hate to see him in the shape he was when I last saw him, and that was several years ago. And he, by all accounts, necessarily has deteriorated significantly. Then he's under conditions that the rapporteur of the UN regarded as torture or inhumane. I'm sure they would like him to die in the course of this. So I'm very anxious to see him get out. And I'm very glad that he does have as many supporters as he does. When I'm on symposia with this, there's a lot of listeners and on Assange and a lot of people supporting him, which is very good. And a lot of newsmen and women who dissociate with him because they don't like him. They don't realize, I think, the stakes for investigative journalism if he is not supported and he is convicted.
Yeah, thank you. And I agree with you about the totalitarian implications of it and just this hope that out of nothing else but the desire to protect their own legitimacy, they will somehow let him be free, but that hasn't happened yet. So I think your advocacy for him is really admirable. Peter Dale Scott, I definitely want to hear from you.
Yes, I'm bursting with things to speak. I want to praise Dan on two levels. We've talked mostly about his releasing the Pentagon Papers and how that produced his being attacked for the first time under the Espionage Act. But the year in which the papers were published, 1971, if you look up the word whistleblower in the Oxford English Dictionary, you will see that the first recorded use they give of the word, meaning what Dan did, is 1971. And Dan has created, he has normalized an activity which has become really, in effect, part of the Constitution, because one of the church reforms after Watergate was the Inspector General's Act, and that has been strengthened three or four times since, and one of the protections is actually legally called the Whistleblower Protection Act. We now count on whistleblowers to help keep our government going in the right direction. The first impeachment of Trump was due to a whistleblower who was protected by an act which is recognizing the importance of what Dan did. And I've talked about Dan many times, and what I praised in the poem was his sitting on the railway tracks at a nuclear plant, Rocky Flats in Colorado. He was sitting there with a poet, Allen Ginsberg, because they wanted to block the train that was carrying materials out of that plant. And the important thing about that is that Dan and Alan didn't know that the train was going to stop. In other words, he was risking his life in the most literal way you can imagine. And that's what Dan got from his exposure to nonviolence. And I think that maybe 400 years from now, Dan may be remembered more for what he did to the history of nonviolent action in the world. I see this as a contest that goes back to the Old Testament between bottom-up power, what people can do, and top-down power, what the authorities are always doing, which is oppressing. And I think that what Dan did, you know, it inspired Brian Wilson to do the same thing out here a decade later at Port Chicago, and the train didn't stop. And Brian lost both his legs, his skull was open, people could see his brain. Why is that important? Because these are the things that change what people can do if they really want to change history, is to risk their life. The Christian church was built, what they called the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church. And we don't have many people who are willing to be martyrs. I may sound a bit old-fashioned by talking about in this way, but I am totally engrossed now. I'm writing a book about it. The importance of the struggle in history as bottom-up power represented by Dan sitting on the tracks and top-down power represented by the people who arrested him and threw him out on the street at 3 a.m. I didn't know that story until today. That, to me, is the most important aspect. In the short run, Dan helping to stop the war, helping to overthrow Nixon, all of that, of course, is very important in the short run. But in the long run, strengthening the forces of nonviolence against the forces of violence, I think, is the most important thing we can do with our lives. And so I just want to raise the conversation to that level of abstraction. What happens on a cultural level, these changes of the values that we think they're harder to talk about and to concretize. But Dan sitting on the railway tracks is a very visual embodiment of that. So I want to praise Dan for that.
I'm so glad that I'm hearing this, that this is not a wake or a roast. It's wonderful to be able to hear tributes like this from your friends and people I admire and respect while I'm alive. I didn't know this was going to be this. I thought it was just going to be students. But by the way, we haven't heard yet from someone here, in addition to Peter, who is definitely a hero of mine. And when it comes to whistleblowers, she represents, I think, the single one who did it right in terms of putting out current information while there was still a chance to avoid a war. Putting it out after the war has started, or has been going for years, as I did, is not very likely to have any effect. And indeed, when Catherine Gunn put out her information, it was before the war, and she had a real chance of stopping it because Blair had said that he would not actually help the U.S. invade Iraq without a second resolution from the U.N. Well, Catherine Gunn's revelations absolutely blocked, were uniquely responsible for blocking that second resolution and having the U.N. Security Council join the U.S. and Britain in aggression against Iraq. As a matter of fact, had they done so, it wouldn't be defined as aggression. But when they refrained from that, from the authorization by the Security Council, it did define what the U.S. is doing as clearly a crime against the peace. Now, of course, Blair's desire to be next to the U.S. in whatever they did, like Trump supporters in his former cabinet now, and like the Republican Party right now, was willing to ignore his earlier pledge that he would need UN Security Council authorization to go in. So it didn't stop the war. It had a real chance to do so. And Catherine is the one, unlike any of the other whistleblowers I can think of, who at first view of this crime, starting, as she put it, an illegal war by illegal means, attempting to blackmail members of the UN Security Council by listening to their private conversations, she acted expeditiously and in time. So if you ask what I've been trying to teach all this time, or somebody else asked me about Assange, what advice? Do it now. Just last month, I was very worried that Trump in his last throes here would start war with Iran. And he was really going that. And I was putting out stuff that said, don't delay. If you have information that we're planning to provoke Iran into an action that will justify a full-scale war with Iran, don't do what I did. Don't wait till the bombs are falling or the war has started. And I could have said what Catherine Gunn did. And unfortunately, not many people would have known that because the U.S. press very effectively blotted out the whole story, what she had done and the legal proceedings and everything else. The New York Times simply didn't write a word of it at that time. Blotted out, so they don't know her name. So I had to put it, do what I wish I had done in 1964 or 1961 and put out this information. And fortunately, they didn't want at the last minute a discussion of the legality of the war in a courtroom. And Catherine did not go to prison, as it looked likely that she would otherwise. But anyway, she is my example of timely whistleblowing. And I'm so glad she's here.
Thank you, Dan. That was very sweet. Well, actually, I feel a little bit embarrassed because I didn't know anything about Dan until way after my leak. In fact, after my case was dropped. But it's almost exactly 20 years now since I started working at GCHQ. So it's to this month, 20 years to this month, I started working at GCHQ. And I had no idea. I mean, I hadn't even heard of the term whistleblower. It was not something that I was familiar with. And it certainly wasn't something I ever thought of myself doing. But anyway, so when I did leak the information, I felt very much alone. I had nobody to talk to. I was trying to keep my head down. I didn't want people to know that it was me. And for 8 months, I was bailed. So I wasn't charged for 8 months. And I was basically trying to get on with my life as an anonymous person. And then they charged me in November 2003 for breaking the Official Secrets Act. And I was facing a prosecution. And it was at that point where I was charged that my name came out publicly. And that's when people in the US, like Dan Ellsberg, like Norman Solomon, like Peter Kuznick, and all the other progressive activists, anti-war activists, suddenly got wind of my name and what was happening and what I'd done prior to the invasion of Iraq. And then all of a sudden, I got this flood of support, mainly from the US, principally from the US, from people who read your news releases, your press releases, and your articles, encouraging people to support me. And it was an enormous sort of morale boosting experience, from going to feeling like nobody understood where I was coming from, to suddenly getting literally hundreds of emails from American citizens all around the US. And after my case was dropped, I remember having an email discussion, I think it was with you, Dan, and you asked me if I had a computer, if I had a laptop or anything at home that I could communicate with. And this was in 2004. This is March, April 2004. And I didn't have a computer. In fact, I was still going to the library to use the library computers or internet cafe to use the computers there. And I remember Dan saying to me, you must get yourself a computer and I will send you some money so that you can go out and buy yourself a very good laptop so that you can start using it wherever you are. And that was my first ever laptop, was courtesy of Dan Ellsberg. Thank you very much. It was a very generous and kind donation. And it was the only computer that lasted us 10 years. None of my other laptops have lasted that long because I didn't know what I was doing. So I think I got conned and I ended up buying one of the most expensive laptops they had in the shop. But anyways, it was since then I had several meetings with Dan. I went to the US on a couple of occasions, met with Dan, met with people that I tend to call the usual suspects. Generally get together for these events, anti-war events and so on. And what was really special, I think, for both of us, I hope, was when the film came out 2 years ago, the film that was recounting my story, Official Secrets. And it was at the Castro Theater where I first saw it in the US in San Francisco at the Castro Theater. And we had a meeting in a bar just before we went to the theater to watch the film. And Dan was able to come, and it was a great experience to actually, you know, have this thing that I never expected to happen, to become a whistleblower. And then subsequently, you know, 19 or 17 years later, for my story to be turned into a film. That was a special moment. I really, really am grateful that I was able to experience that. And I just want to thank you, Dan, for always being so supportive of all the people like myself and all the subsequent whistleblowers that have come, because it is a lonely experience when you feel as though you have nobody who understands where you're coming from and what you're going through. So thank you for all your hard work. And you're always such a great storyteller with fascinating stories to tell. And, you know, your beautiful smile always warms the cockles of my heart. So thank you very much.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Special thanks again for today's program to Aaron Good and our senior producer, Anthony Fest. We're listening to a conversation with Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg and several other notable authors and activists, which was arranged by Aaron Good at a Philadelphia high school where he teaches. We just heard the British whistleblower Catherine Gunn, who exposed U.S. spying on other nations' U.N. missions as the George W. Bush administration attempted to build world support for its 2003 invasion of Iraq. After this break, we'll hear the concluding portion of the conversation where Ellsberg and his friends discuss challenges the peace movement faces in the future. Stay with us.
We are getting towards the end here of the class. And Dan, I hope that you are happily surprised that this was less of a Q&A and more of a tribute slash Q&A. I think my students have read and we've discussed so much of your work that I felt like this Zoom business gave us a great opportunity to bring people together for something different that could capture something else rather than what is normally there in interviews. I don't have as many anecdotes about Dan as some of these people, but I have been very blessed to be able to spend time with him for the better part of a week in Philadelphia, driving him around and hosting some events, hosting a George School event and attending an event at Swarthmore with him. And then later driving around San Francisco area with Dan and Peter when we did some interviews a few years ago, which for me was really wonderful because I had known these men much more than they knew me because of the internet. And after I became more radicalized after the Obama campaign I worked on, and Obama turned into more of another imperialist, and it radicalized me. And so I just started reading and listening to all of these interviews of people. And so I'd listen to hours and hours and hours of Dan talking and Peter Del Scott talking. So it was a real thrill to meet Dan. And when we were at Swarthmore, Dan was giving a talk to a packed auditorium, and I'd given him my paper the night before, and Dan gave me the nicest compliment and shout out and mention during this talk, which was kind of gratuitous and yet so generous, I thought. And I think that's really emblematic of the other stories that people shared about him, his generosity of spirit. But also, he delivered the nicest and most precise zinger that night of sorts. I don't exactly want to call it a zinger, but it was in that family. And there was a person we were talking to at the table who was a retired Swarthmore professor, and he had worked with Samuel Huntington. And I was still in graduate school, so I was complaining about Samuel Huntington and saying that I disagreed with everything he wrote in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and it was remarkable how his imprint. And this other fellow who was more in line with us, but defended Huntington out of some loyalty in some ways. And then Dan finally at the end of this says, well, can I ask you this? Was Sam Huntington ever right about anything? And this fellow, it wasn't offensive because he wasn't exactly trying to argue his perspective, but it actually caused a transition to another subject because he had no response. And I felt it was, he needed to tell the truth, but he did it in the nicest way that he could. And it was really memorable.
Aaron, can I add a couple things?
Of course.
First, on Sam Huntington. Huntington was right once. He said the West won the world not by the superiority of its ideas or values or religion, but by the superior application of organized violence. Westerners often forget that fact. Non-Westerners never do. So I think that was the one time he got it right.
Peter, that illustrates, I think you and other people have heard me say in recent times, a postulate of mine at 89, you can't rely on anyone to be wrong about everything all the time. And you've just illustrated that. As Aaron was talking about Sam Huntington, it came into my head that Huntington was an exception to that. So you can't set your compass entirely by any person. You have to keep your ears open. I give credit when somebody's right. Even when Trump said, why can't we be friendly with Russia? All right. Yeah, why not? And for whatever his motives were for his strange appreciation of Putin and Russia, I preferred that than going to war. So you've got to be open to the possibility that anyone you know as an almost perfect compass toward the wrong direction might possibly, if you hear them being right, it might be the case. And Peter has just demonstrated that.
I've got one more story for the students that you might appreciate, that it isn't all pain and suffering. Dan is the only person I know who three of the four Beatles lined up to get Dan's autograph. And I think, I could be wrong on this, but I think it was at a reception for Dan thrown by Barbara Streisand.
It was a fundraiser for our trial. It happened to be on my birthday, April 7th, which raised enough money to keep the trial going, which was out of money at that point. And literally, trial would have ended, and it would have ended before the word of the Fielding break-in got to the courthouse, which brought Nixon down eventually. Had the trial ended earlier, which we all would have been, we were ready to go, but without this extra money that Barbara Streisand raised at this particular party, which, as you say, had Beatles and other people in it, he would have stayed in office, and the war would have continued until 77 at least, and his successor, I think, would not have stopped the bombing in support of our puppet troops in Vietnam. Could have gone on for a long time. We have now learned how long Americans will put up with spending American money to kill other people from the air. 19 years in Afghanistan and about the same in Iraq. In other words, if a president can get a war to where he only involved air power and hardly any casualties, American casualties, the American people will accept that imperial rule. In other words, we have an imperial public to a large extent, and it's not only the people who listen to Fox News. That's what I think Catherine recognized when she saw this as basically imperial in the worst way, you know, in the case of Iraq, as it was. And she acted against it. and of course, Peter, both Peters here, Peter Dale Scott and your cousin, have done more than anyone else I can think of to enlighten the world, along with Noam Chomsky and a few others, and Jamie Galbraith, right here, to try to make people recognize that we are what I call a covert empire, covert in the sense of plausible denial of what we are and what we're doing and the means we use. And people are in that state of denial very successfully. The words regime change now are used as though it's a perfectly normal activity of the government to decide who shall govern somebody else, who shall die, who shall go into prison. We have a right to decide if we don't like them. So you see regime change now, which is the definition of empire, virtually a believed right and ability to determine the governments of other countries. It just is accepted now. But anyway, we have to change. And of course, simply moving Trump for Biden does not change that. It doesn't change the defense budget or our intervention policy or whatnot. But to think that that means then there's no change, as some people do, is that's absurd on the domestic side and on climate and on other things, on the pandemic. But in terms of changing our role of, as Martin Luther King said, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world in the pursuit of covert empire, that remains, and we have to change that. So thank you for this. This has been wonderful, Aaron.
I think that we can leave it at there. I think that your words about the empire were a great way to wrap it up and reiterate the main thing that we're living under, and that you've done so much work to expose and continue to inspire people with your example and your erudition and your humanity. So I'm so thankful that you came here today and everyone else that joined us. Thank you all again, and especially you, Dan.
And Peter and Jamie and the students, but I look forward to seeing the students again. I have my friends here is really heartwarming. That's wonderful.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. Today's program is dedicated to the life and memory of the great Lawrence Ferlinghetti, founder of City Lights Books. He passed away recently at the age of 101. We honor Ferlinghetti's long legacy, fighting for First Amendment rights and against censorship. Rest in power, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, City Lights Books. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself, Mickey Huff, along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer and host of the program. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram while we're still there. And be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Feel free to share your feedback or contact us about our work or program ideas at projectcensored.org. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. We got that love of the brothers in.